Hi Vicky.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good stuff. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. Look, Vicky, got you on the Employer Blend podcast today. And first thing I'd like to do is kind of just do a really brief introduction for, lots of people that are listening to this will already know who you are. But the people that don't, Vicky Saunders, the founder of the EVP Consultancy, which I understand is going to be going live probably within the next, well, it's days, isn't it? If
Yeah,
not the next week or so.
next week. Yep.
Super exciting stuff. And as we talk through the podcast, we'll probably come on to the EVP consultancy a little bit more. But yeah, previously EVP culture, employee experience, employer brand leader Currys, and I think many people listening to the podcast will just know you generally from being on the circuit for all things EVP employer brand and being at so many of the major shows throughout the year. But Vicky, just to kind of kick things off, it'd be really nice just to get a little bit of a brief introduction from you, if that's okay, and not kind of one of those sort of superficial, real quick ones of what you've been doing in the last like year or so. But it'd be really nice if you're able to maybe just backtrack a while and talk to us a little bit about some of your earliest influences as well in kind of life and business, and how those kind of early experiences and influences have kind of helped you to meander to where you are today in kicking off your own business, I suppose, in the coming years.
Yeah, sure. So I came from the Black Country, working class Walsall. My parents divorced when I was young. My parents did quite standard jobs for the area that we lived in. My dad went into the leather trade. My mum became a secretary. It was kind of quite, you're a girl, you'll be a secretary. Your dad's a man, so he'll go into the leather trade. And I think I'm that generation where, although my parents both went to grammar schools, they passed the 11 plus and went to grammar schools. They just came back out and went into industry because they were working class, right? So they were obviously intelligent, but the wrong kind of mobility stage in society for that to be anything different. And so I was the first person in our family to go to uni. But there was this always a strong kind of I went to a grammar school as well, again, past the 11 plus. So you don't realize when you land in a grammar school that you're in the top 5% of intelligence levels and all of the rest of it. And my parents weren't very pushing me academically. So I actually just got to really enjoy school. I just loved it. I found the whole of school fascinating. I loved history and geography. I found out that I was good at languages. I did German and French, later went on to speak Spanish as well. But yeah, I think that whole thing around learning and being intensely curious came from the fact that my parents were actually quite intelligent. We used to have quite big conversations at the dinner table in the evenings. And I went to that type of school. But there's also, I suppose, there was a bit of me. I remember when I was having my A levels predicted for university, because you have to, someone in your school has to predict what your grades are going to be, and then da 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 da. And that they predicted me CCD, I think. CCD? No, BCC. Predicted me BCC. And I went, well, to go to Leeds, I'm going to need a BBC. And they went, right, okay, well, we'll put that down on the form. That's not our recommendation. That's not what we think you will achieve, Vicky. But we'll put it on the form, but on your head be it if you don't get those grades. I'm like, right, okay. And I got three A's and a B. There's a bit of me that I suppose just got triggered by this. Because although I was at a grammar school, the majority of the other girls there's parents were doctors, lawyers, surgeons, whatever. And my parents worked in factories. They put my back up.
Yeah, I
They put
bet.
my back up. And I'm like, right, I'm going to prove you wrong. And I did. So there's a bit of, I don't know, I quite early on had
Yeah.
to prove what Vicky was about and prove my abilities and believe in myself,
I really like that. Do you think that's kind of followed through as well in your career, Vicky? Because that kind of almost fighting for what's right and, you know, I suppose needing to kind of try and punch above your weight as well at times in situations where you thought, you know, I am good enough actually. And
yeah,
it almost seems as though the career that you've kind of, that you've taken on and the work that you do now, you seem to, you also do that for other people as well.
Yeah.
Make it more fair for other people. And
yes.
You know, it's, and it probably sounds a bit cliche, me framing it in that way, but do you think those early experiences have kind of taken you on a certain path?
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose earlier on in my career, I did have a fair bit of what we call these days imposter syndrome. That wasn't, we called it 20 years ago, but I did have that. But then the more I worked hard, and particularly when I went into leadership roles, the more feedback I had from the people who worked for me and my colleagues about my leadership style completely changed the way that I viewed myself, you know, because I realized that I am a good people leader. I'm a big collaborator. I invest in other people's development. I love nurturing talent. The amount of people who've worked for me who have gone on to be, you know, directors in other organizations, I just get so happy and thrilled that I've contributed to that, you know. So I suppose over time, it's more that the feedback that I've had from the people in the teams that I've led has changed my perception about who I am and what I can offer. And also there was a stage when I was going through quite a big change when I was working at Boots. I decided to leave the marketing team. I was making big TV ads, £12 million campaigns, award-winning campaigns. I looked after Christmas, which is the biggest campaign you can run. And then when I had my first daughter, I didn't want to be the person on speed dial from every member of the exco because I looked after Christmas. And I wanted to do something different. And I went through a bit of a, well, what else do I do? I'm a marketeer. I make TV ads. This is what I do, you know, and I've been doing it for 9 years at Boots. They started calling me the Oracle, you know, everyone who was about to make a TV ad, go and ask Vic. She knows how to do that. She knows, you know what I mean? And but so to leave that position of being a true subject matter expert and do something different was quite a big change. And I discovered at that stage a guy called Marcus Buckingham.
Okay.
He wrote a book called Now Discover Your Strengths, and it completely changed the way I thought about talent generally, but me specifically within an organization, because he strongly believes that your inherent skills and talents are from you from birth. They're with you from birth. You can pick up other stuff, you can build skills, but there are some things which are just inherent. And typically the stuff that you look forward to, that you find energizing, you'll see that that's the stuff you're actually really good at as well. And so instead of this premise where I thought, and certainly Boots at the time was like this, it was a bit kind of like, right, you're at this grade in the organization, and to be able to get to the next grade, you need to, you know, grow your financial acuity or whatever. And I realized that that's not actually how it works. That's not how I wanted to work. And the trick is to find the stuff that you love, that you're really good at, and do more of that stuff.
Yeah.
You can't play into your strengths, right? And find the roles that allow you to do more of that stuff rather than the stuff that everyone's going around your development needs. Do you know what I mean? Because fundamentally, when you get to a position of leadership, the stuff that's on your development needs, you just find someone else who can help you with that. I was watching an interview with Richard Branson the other day, and he was talking about how he, his CFO pulled him aside in a meeting, and he was already in his 50s by this point in time, and said to him, Richard, can I just check, do you actually know the difference between gross and net? He goes, no, I haven't got a clue what the difference is. That's why I need you to tell me, is it good news or bad news? And it's like, wow. And that's Richard Branson, you know?
Yeah.
When you do get to a certain stage in leadership, you you can build out the skills in your team to be able to complement your strengths, you know?
Absolutely.
And certainly ever since then, since I moved in, I then went into a completely different role. I went into customer proposition development, developing new pharmacy services for Boots. So clinical services, nothing to do with making TV ads, right?
Yeah.
But I then knew that my skills were around, you know, conceptual thinking, analytical thinking. I knew that I could come up with concepts using data and insights to build new propositions. And so that's shaped me ever since. And each career step that I've taken ever since has been closer and closer to the heart of what Vicky's energized by and what she's good at.
Yeah, I love that. So just moving into the EVP consultancy, and it would just be, you know, because you and I haven't actually spoken about the EVP consultancy at all until today, really. But if you could give me an insight, so from that background and all the work that you've done in your career today, moving through into the EVP consultancy, what is the kind of breadth of work? Hopefully you don't just say EVP, but it's obviously EVP related, but what is the breadth of work that you're going to be carrying out for the companies that you partner with?
So the market gap that I see is that many organizations either don't have an EVP, which is, I think, is slightly bonkers. I think it's like going into the dragon's den without a customer proposition, you know? So your customer proposition informs your commercial strategy. Your employee proposition should inform your HR strategy, but many people don't have an EVP. So what's the HR strategy built on? Yeah. You know? So I see a market gap, which is around lots of big agencies, either employer brand agencies, HR, big consultancies, culture consultancies, who are great at doing EVP, but fundamentally you're talking six figures, easily 100, 200 grand for the support of those experts. And I work with them. I know a lot of them. They are brilliant at what they do, but that is just fundamentally too far of a stretch commercially for some smaller organizations to be able to reach that level, to be able to do their EVP. So they're faced with doing their EVP themselves, right? Yep. And EVP is both exciting, brilliant. Wow, this could be foundation. This could be, you know, transformational for our organization if we get this right. But many HR professionals have never done it before, right? They've never been in the organization at the right time that it's come up on the strategy and some budget's been put aside it. And so there's this daunting feeling of, but how do we do it? Because actually it's a marketeer's skill set that does an EVP, not a recruiter's. Do you know what I mean? It's about proposition crafting. And so the role of the EVP consultancy, as I see it, is to partner with organizations so that they do it in-house, but with support, different levels of support from me. So that could be training on how to develop the EVP, plus some coaching when they go through the actual process, each of the milestones, check in with me. Or it could be that I helicopter into the organization and do some of the bits for them. They're like, we're good with doing the leadership interviews, but we would love you to come and facilitate the focus groups. Or, you know, we can do a survey, but we've got no idea how to design it. Can you design the survey part for us? And so I will flex around the capabilities and the resources within the organization to build a joint methodology for their EVP development. But EVP development is only the first stage, do you see? And I've seen some horror stories, Chris. I don't know if you've heard them, really, about, in effect, people pay for the development and they end up with a 100 grand PowerPoint presentation. I mean, like, wow. Yeah. They don't activate it, right? And so the true power of the EVP comes out in the activation. It could be through the employer brand, absolutely. If the goals of the organization are around attracting, you know, they have a problem with attraction and high attrition, but equally it could be around, you know, low satisfaction in the organization, and you can then activate the EVP more through some advocacy work, through internal comms, through the employee experience. So I see it as kind of a holistic piece, that but absolutely is about activation as well as development.
Yeah, I get that. And it's really interesting what you say about kind of, you know, a lot of people in these organizations will have the skill set, or certainly with a little bit of, you know, some mentoring and nurturing, they'll be able to do a lot of this work. But yeah. I think fundamentally, you know, certainly in my own experiences, what seems to be lacking is that the strategy and the blueprint piece of, yes, like, okay, we understand there's like, you know, 20 different chapters to this book, but we don't know what chapter one is, and we don't know what chapter 20 is, and we don't know which order every chapter in between needs to go in.
Yeah.
And I think, like you say, I think having someone that's like, look, I kind of want you to be able to do this work yourself. I'm at this point a facilitator and just slowly kind of showing you how it's done.
Yeah.
Of what's missing a lot of the time, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you're delivering a PowerPoint presentation and you're still completely none the wiser about activation, or even how that PowerPoint presentation was put together, not that it's any use anyway, it's kind of a bit of a waste of time. So I love the sound of it.
And there's a behavioral science piece behind it as well, which is, you heard of the IKEA effect?
No.
The IKEA effect is this concept that we are all more invested in anything that we have helped create. So whether that's flat pack furniture from IKEA, you emotionally feel more about that product than if it's just landed off the back of a John Lewis delivery van or wherever, Argos, you know. Yeah. So the IKEA concept is that an EVP, the more it is created and the people in the organization are involved in it, the more it will be engaged in and embed, really become foundational and part of the culture within that organization. If it's done too remotely, and especially if it's done top down, if it's done with just sitting in the room with the whole of the exco and say, right, what do you think the EVP should be? It's not gonna land.
It's not gonna
get hearts and minds.
Yeah, well, it sounds great. I love the sound of it, and yeah, good stuff. So look, moving into the main conversation, the first thing I wanted to cover off with you, Vicky, if it's okay, is that certainly from some of my own observations, there seems to be a theme, certainly with EVPs this is, but a theme of creating the blueprint of what kind of a company already has, and basing the EVP almost entirely around the status quo. You know, what have we got here today? As opposed to maybe some thought about the kind of, I suppose, the, you know, where are we heading? Where are we traveling? You know, and what does the future look like? Is that something, you know, what are your kind of general thoughts on that when you're in the early phases of scoping out an EVP project?
Yeah, so you're right. It's a common and big mistake to focus too much on the organization that you have today. Was it Henry Ford who said, you know, if you do what you've always done, you'll get what you've always got, you know? So you need to think at the beginning of an EVP project about the, I mean, ideally, depending on the size of your organization, the maturity of the HR team, whatever, you might have a beautifully articulated strategic workforce plan, which clearly dovetails into the commercial growth plan of the organization. So it's already been mapped out and says, you know, in order for us to go after this new revenue opportunity, we're going to need more data scientists or solution architects. And so you already have some of that information, ideally, when you start the EVP project, because what you'll find is that often there are skill sets you need more of in the future than you have today. But in today's workforce, if you just took 5% of the workforce, say, as a microcosm of everything that you've got, let's say you chose 5% of the people who are in finance, and because that's what makes 5% makes your finance makes up 5% of the organization, or you know, 30% of the organization is made up of commercial, then the people we talk to in the focus groups and the survey will give that 30% worth of the weight, right? But that gives you what you've already got. what you need to do is upweight the bits you want more of in the future. So if you do want more solution architects, data scientists, software engineers, blah, blah, you need to find more of the ones in the organization than are naturally there today. So if you've only got three of them, you have to put all three in, even though it might, do you know what I mean? It's not just about skills, but equally, same is true for workforce demographics. For example, you're an engineering firm, like, you know, we were at BAE. BAE's the biggest engineering firm in the UK. There is absolutely an ambition to bring more women into engineering, you know, but it's a country mile away from where it needs to be. And so when we did the focus groups, surveys, interviews at BAE, we put more women into those than are naturally there as a percentage of the organisation.
Yeah,
because we knew that's where we needed to be in the future, because the EVP had to be fit for purpose to attract and retain more women in the future.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. So is it kind of almost fair to say that there should be an element of gap analysis in a way
that
is done before it's kind of thinking, okay, kind of, you know, where is the direction of travel and where are we heading is super important, you know, based on what you said. I completely get that. But also, okay, and you know, there's some holes in this bucket at the moment as well. Can we kind of address what those look like?
Yeah, it's self-directed direction of travel.
Yeah.
But you get to a point of clarity on what you want your workforce to be and look like in the future. But it's also about where the world is going. You know, what the workforce, future of workplace trends are. And thinking about, well, where is that heading and where do we sit on that as well in the future? So, again, if you've decided that you truly want to have to get after the remote hybrid model, then you're going to want to talk to more of your workers who are in hybrid remote roles now to ensure that the proposition that you develop is going to be fit for them if actually you're going to close down offices and everything else. Do you know what I mean? It's about that future projection.
Makes so much sense. Makes a lot of sense. So in regards to, you know, let's say you're in a project and you get to the point of you're in discovery, you're in workshops, and you've got all that great work going on. And you know, there, I'd imagine, you know, you'd know this way better than I would, but I'd imagine there probably gets a point, certainly in much larger organizations, where there are aspects of maybe negativity or things that, like, oh, you know, I asked that question but that wasn't the answer I was expecting. I really wanted to get a completely different answer to that. But you know, there's things coming into the fold from the discovery work that, you know, are bordering on the kind of line of negativity, and like, oh, this isn't all great stuff. It's not all the sweetness and roses I thought it would be.
Yeah.
Is there an element of, you know, do you think a lot of that stuff often gets swept under the carpet because it's like, look, that's not who we want to be and where we want to go, and we don't really want to do much with that? Is there something that can be done? You know, can you start bottling this stuff up, embracing that kind of stuff, and actually in the good somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, you have to own it. You can't just cherry pick the good bits of what comes out of a focus group and go, oh, that's our slogan, that's our strap line, let's use that for our external campaign. That's, you know, it's never going to wash. The what I tend to find is in the organizations that don't have a strong colleague listening strategy, you end up with more stuff coming out of the woodwork during an EVP project than in an organization that does have a robust colleague listening strategy, because it becomes, you're asking people about why they joined, why they stay, what they love about working here, what's not so good about working here, and all kinds of stuff comes out. And if they've not had the opportunity to say that before, then it all comes out in an EVP focus group. Do you know what I mean? So there's part of it is the skill of the facilitator to shape the conversation in the way that it is productive, and that stuff can still get surfaced, but doesn't derail the conversation completely. But I also think there's a duty of care as an EVP practitioner that I see that I have to take those insights back into the organization. At the end of the research phase, I always put in the stuff that has been positive, neutral, and negative, and put down the stuff, because it you know, typically that first milestone of the research phase being complete, you take the insights back up into your stakeholder group. Could be the CPO, it could go right up to the CEO and share the full warts of it. Do you know what I mean? You're not going to fix it all through the EVP, but it absolutely should be built into the understanding of the pain points of the people, and then be built out into what that means for the HR strategy.
Yeah, and I think by doing that, you're just showing traits of empathy. You're showing traits of, you know, we want to be better and we do listen. And, you know, I think just demonstrating that feedback comes through, it gets processed and change is made. I think that speaks volumes as well, doesn't it? Everybody does stuff badly, and there's never a perfect workplace, is there? But I think showing that you listen and you strive to be better is, there's nothing, you can't ask for a lot more than that, can you? So in that same vein, you know, when we're looking at these EVP projects, do you often come up against, or have you seen, you know, whether you've been involved in them or heard about them or whatever, where EVP projects and larger scale programs have kind of been almost approved and been managed as a bit of a box ticking exercise by the C-suite? It's like, we've heard about this EVP thing. Yeah, they seem really popular. We need to have one. We haven't got one at the moment, or we have got one, but it was done 5-10 years ago. Apparently we need a refresh. Mm. Okay, fine, let's tick that box and get it done. Do you see a lot of that? And why? And if you do ever see that, do you think there are any fundamental reasons as to why some people still see it as a box ticking exercise?
I have partly seen it as a box ticking exercise. It's a little bit of, oh, this is trendy, let's get on that boat. Unfortunately, with a lot of C-suite, they don't actually understand what an EVP is, or have their experience of it has been based around a different stage in the organization's challenges. So, you know, if an EVP was developed, it could have been developed 5 years ago. And let's say they had 20% vacancy rate at the time, right? And they were struggling. I mean, seriously, struggling to operationally keep the business running with the level of vacancies they got. Then it becomes an imperative to say, okay, we need to change. We need to craft the proposition in order to attract people into these vacancies. The business case is then, you know, it's plain to see. It's obvious, isn't it?
Yeah.
But if the issue isn't so much around high vacancy rates or high attrition, then actually people don't quite understand what the point of an EVP is. And so there's more of a job to do in educating and helping people understand that. So, for example, we talked earlier about the role EVP plays in increasing workforce diversity. Yeah. Equally, it could be around how it plays a role in career development and you know, that impacts satisfaction, which impacts productivity. You know, all of these things are never clearly enough articulated, I don't think, in the boardroom. And some of that is, I suppose, because I come from a commercial background. So I spent time as a customer proposition developer, and I had to put together business cases for investment to launch a new product, which was a service, a pharmacy service. And I had to be able to project what the revenue, profit, blah, 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 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, blah, 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 blah. You know what I mean? So when you're walking into the boardroom and you're asking for EVP investment, I often find HR professionals are kind of, because they're not in commercial roles, they're not as kind of on their toes with the kind of things that other people are bringing into the boardroom, but are in effect in competition with those other people. You're going to have someone from the property team coming in and talking about renovations that need doing, £3 million, please, Mr. Boardroom. Or you're going to have the customer team talking about how you know, delivery services or, you know, supply chain or whatever, you're going to have all of these different people coming into the room asking for their money from Mr. Boardroom, Mr. and Mrs. Boardroom, and HR come in the room, and because they're not speaking that language, probably because a lot of HR professionals are in the profession for a vocational reason, that they want to be able to help people, and for, you know, they believe in improving workforce conditions and caring for people. So it isn't necessarily a natural skill set that comes with that vocational positioning as part of their career. So, but it's absolutely imperative. And I think if HR is going to get more of a clout and therefore more budget, and for us to see more CPOs to become CEOs in the future, we have to get better at speaking that commercial financial language. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, because bottom line impact is something certainly the C-suite, they talk about day in, day out, isn't it?
Yeah.
And as well, I think, you know, certainly my own experience, you know, when EVP is discussed, there seems to be this blanket thing, you know, EVP, and then it's discussed at it's super high level, as opposed to quite often, you know, thinking about the much smaller, like micro elements of, like, you know, for example, there's been loads of attrition in our data science team in London, and it's a revolving door. What the hell is going on?
Yeah.
Like, it's very rarely, it's like, well, you know, what have we done with our EVP on that exact, you know, have we done satisfaction surveys or whatever, or just, you know, have we had one-to-ones with our data scientists in the last whatever to just actually get to some form of root cause? But it's quite rarely, like, I don't think there's enough kind of correlation to EVP with micro business impact stuff.
And that's it's interesting, because I think some of that is structural.
Yeah.
And a bit behavioural, because certainly in some organisations, you're going to end up, HR is going to split into your business partnering team and your COEs, right? An EVP is a strategic piece of work, sits in the COEs. And what you were just describing about, right, got a problem in the data science teams, that would typically be the first port of call to be able to diagnose that problem, look for fixes, etc., is sitting in the business partnering team. It'd be the HRVP that would look at that, and there needs to be more connectivity across the business partnering team and the COEs, so that it comes together and affects the ongoing strategy. But it often in organizations that the two are just way too siloed, it's scary.
Hence why they need a more robust blueprint, which imagine you can help with, but absolutely. So looking at one thing I'm really interested to actually learn more about as well, because I've got some learning to do in this space, but I know that there is a strong relationship clearly between EVP and employer brand.
Yeah.
But even myself sometimes get confused with the direct relationship, and which elements are done first and which elements of EVP impact, you know, employer brand and vice versa and all this kind of stuff. But if possible, you know, it would be great just to get your kind of insights on that relationship and what that relationship looks like.
Sure. So I have an analogy for this, where I talk about chocolate. Do you like chocolate?
I love chocolate.
Oh, good. Right. Well, this might make you hungry. We're talking at 11:45 in the morning, so it's a good job lunch is coming soon. So I talk about Mars bars when I talk about this. So that the if you think about how a Mars bar is made, there'll be some raw ingredients, right? There'll be some sugar. There will be some vanilla, maybe some cocoa beans, some fat, probably in the form of milk to make the chocolate. Blah, blah, blah. Raw ingredients that make up a Mars bar are in effect the same as an employee experience. Mm-hmm. So the onboarding experience, or the promotion experience, or the payroll experience, or you know, all of the other aspects. They're the raw experience. But Mars, that isn't a Mars bar. When you get a Mars bar, it's actually already been made into caramel and chocolate and nougat, right? Three main components. They're like the pillars of your EVP. So the Mars bar that you eat, forget the wrapper for a second, but you're thinking about eating a Mars bar. It's already had design that's gone into it, right? Because you've already made caramel, nougat, and milk chocolate. So it's not the raw ingredients. That is the EVP. The naked Mars bar is what you get in exchange for your 90p, £1, £1.10. You live in Essex, so it might be even more. It's about 85p for me here in Nottinghamshire. That's the EVP. It's what you get in exchange, you know? So, and then when you put the wrapper on it, black with the red logo, that's the brand. You've given it a personality. You've given it an identity. And that's what people know and recognize you for. And people talk sometimes about, do you control your brand? Do other people control your brand? I believe personally that your brand is what you say about yourself.
Yeah.
And what other people say about you is your reputation.
Mm.
So the employer brand is the wrapper, the Mars bar wrapper. Then the last bit is when you go into a supermarket or your local shop and you see Mars amongst your Bounty, your Crunchy, M&M's, blah, blah. I'll shut up about chocolate. I can see you drooling, Chris.
Oh, no, I am. I think maybe really hungry.
There you might see, you know, point of sale material, win a holiday to Barbados, promotion code on pack, right? That is recruitment marketing. That's when you've got loads of Mars bars in the shop, all alongside each other, all the brands competing, that's us on job boards. All of our vacancies on job boards competing amongst everybody else. And that's recruitment marketing. This is me, that's the difference between employee experience is the raw ingredients. EVP is the Mars bar without the wrapper. It's the caramel nougat chocolates, that experience that you get, the taste, the smell, the employer brand is the wrapper. And then when you go into a shop and you've got promotional material, trying to persuade you to sell it, to buy it, that's your recruitment marketing.
I love that. Great analogy. You definitely made me very, very hungry.
Sorry.
Wanting chocolate. Great analogy. And do you think, this just last kind of question on it, Vicky, you know, is it possible to create an employer brand or develop an employer brand without the fundamental EVP work?
Yes. Yes, it is. It's not best practice. Because you are building on a creative view of your organization rather than the fundamental truth of the organization. So that the EVP work draws out, like we said earlier, you know, warts and all, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And you get a really clear picture of your unique differentiated position versus your talent competitors that matches with the talent segments that you want to attract. Whereas an employer brand, without having done that foundational work, is trying to look more through the lens of creative execution. It's more looking at those talent competitors and their messaging, their creative, their campaigns, and trying to come up with something differentiated purely from a creative point of view.
Yeah,
which does have some merit. It doesn't necessarily fall flat on its face, but it doesn't have the foundation and substance to it. You know how Paul Hollywood talks about style over substance on Bake Off.
Making me more hungry now, Vicky.
To me, doing employer brand without having an EVP clear, it is a bit like that.
And I'd imagine the shelf life of that employer brand, you know, without the foundational work, I'd imagine it's got a much shorter shelf life as well. That's more of a campaign based, quick in and out, like we're going to try and put a plaster over this.
Yeah, it's less stable. It's less stable, isn't it? And it probably cost you more in the long run because you're going to have to keep coming up with new creative, new campaigns to keep it fresh, da-da-da-da-da. So actually an employer brand agency might love that because they get more money. I don't know.
Every year. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Reinvent the employer brand. What's this year's employer brand? Shouldn't be like that, though, you know?
No, absolutely shouldn't. No, I'd agree with that. So Vicky, it's been brilliant talking. We've come to kind of the tail end of the talk, but one thing that we always finish on, if it's okay to spring this on you, is one last parting question. But for anybody listening that is putting together, the foundational work of a new EVP, or they're embarking on a new employer brand journey, are there any kind of tips that you can share on how to avoid being employer bland?
There's a real tendency in the employer, actually in all of marketing, it happens in consumer marketing too, but definitely in employer branding, because it's a less mature model. Employer branding's only like 25, 30 years old, whereas consumer marketing much, much longer. There's this tendency to look at what your competitors are doing and go, oh, let's try that, right? Let's copy and paste, right? But without this thought of, just because they're doing it, you can't assume that it's actually working. It might not actually be effective. They might not be measuring it. And they might be keeping doing it because they're not measuring it and they don't know that it's actually bombing. So you could be copying something which is fundamentally rubbish. So there's a bit of, I think, just thinking for yourself about thinking about what do we need to, if anything, if you want some inspiration, I would look outside of employer branding entirely. I would look at what a brand in Japan, a consumer brand are doing in Japan, a hospitality brand are doing in Colombia. Look for something different to give you inspiration. That you can bring into your employer brand mix. Don't copy and paste.
I love that. Yeah, so find your own lane, own it, love it, and develop it.
Yeah.
Love it, brilliant. Well, Vicky, thank you so much for taking the time out. I really appreciate it. And it's honestly been really, really nice talking to you. There's been, some really cool stuff that we've covered there. I've really enjoyed the chat.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I think it was great. I really enjoyed talking too.
Yeah, thanks ever so much, Vicky.
Thank you.
Cheers, bye.
Bye.